The last time there was a migrant crisis like the one in Europe, it was the Europeans trying to get out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 3rd of September. Thank you for being here. We are continuing to watch the crisis in Europe unfold as migrants and refugees make desperate attempts to find new homes. Most countries and various international organizations do have procedures in place to handle refugees, but they are totally overwhelmed. As Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, there hasn't been a global crisis on this scale in decades.
They come from Poland, from Czechoslovakia, from Spain, some even from Germany.
World War II was the last time this many people were forced to flee their homes. Kathleen Newland of the Migration Policy Institute says solutions like an international refugee agency were supposed to be temporary.
The assumption was that it would register people, take care of people for a few years, and then it would be able to essentially go out of business.
The world quickly realized there would always be more refugees and places for them hard to find. Newland says before the recent influx of Syrians, the average refugee stayed a refugee for 17 years.
So you can see that, you know, with that kind of duration, that the old model is just not a realistic model for today.
Joel Millman of the International Organization for Migration says for most of the last few centuries, it's been Europeans fleeing Europe.
And it's only in the last generation or two that they've had to get used to being a migrant destination.
And it's the communities where people finally end up that usually bear most of the financial cost and the benefits. Howard Edelman of Canada's Center for Refugee Studies says the 60,000 refugees who came to Canada between 1979 and 80 cost the country about $1 billion.
The investment in them was so small relative to the productivity they contribute to the society. And this is true in the United States as well.
Globally, only about 1% of refugees are formally resettled. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
One European country that is not interested in resettling immigrants is the UK. Despite growing outrage over the deaths of hundreds of migrants each week and added pressure on European leaders to help these refugees, the UK is taking a hard stance. Unlike Germany, it's tightened its immigration and asylum policies lately. British Prime Minister David Cameron is taking a lot of heat. But the UK says the better path is to end the conflict in Syria and make that country safe so refugees can go home. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
If Britain really wants to deter refugees, it couldn't do better than ask Abdel Al-Bashir how he feels after seeking a safe haven here.
I have depression, I have panic attack, nightmares, flashback on a daily basis.
And he says that's not because of the torture he endured in his native Sudan because of his political activities, but from his treatment in the UK, where he arrived 12 years ago claiming asylum. His claim was rejected and he spent the last decade in and out of detention centres here.
Comparing the two experiences of being physically tortured and being in the UK, or rather prefer the physical torture than being in the UK.
If it's worse here than Sudan, why not go home?
I would love to get out of the UK as soon as possible, but I can't do that. If I ever return back to Sudan, my life will be at real risk.
Mohammed Khalid, please go to the immigration desk. Mohammed Khalid to the immigration desk.
The UK has tightened up its immigration and asylum rules of late. This country now locks up more people deemed to be illegal immigrants than any other European country apart from Greece. And while Germany has put out the welcome mat for 800,000 Syrian refugees, the UK has only accepted a few hundred. But Tony Smith, the former head of Britain's border agency, says that's because the UK has seen one of Europe's biggest influxes of economic migrants over the last decade.
Some estimates saying that, you know, the UK population, really a relatively small country, could rise from something like 60 million now to 80 or 85 million in 20 or 30 years' time.
Largely as a result of immigration.
Indeed.
Before the last UK election this past May, the government promised again to curb immigration to relieve the growing strain on healthcare, housing, education and welfare. And Smith says it has a democratic duty to deliver on that pledge.
You know, it is the will of the people. If a government is elected on a ticket which says, look, you know, we don't want more immigration, then it's really fair enough that that government will introduce measures to maintain a strong immigration control.
On the surface, Britain seems hard-hearted, flintily refusing to accept many more refugees, but there are plenty of people here rooting for migrants. There's even a series of annual awards for Migrant and Refugee of the Year.
And now we're going to go on to our next category, which is the Young Woman of the Year category, and the winner is Cynthia Masiwa.
Cynthia Masiwa arrived here from Zimbabwe 10 years ago. She was aged 15 on her own, and she says fleeing political violence. Her claim for asylum was eventually accepted, and she became a citizen.
I've grown here, I've attended education here, I've worked here, gone to university here. This is where all my foundations are, this is where my business is, this is where my career is progressing.
She runs a brand design consultancy promoted in this video, and she has a small catering firm, as well as working full-time for a charity helping migrants find employment.
England is the land of growth, is the land of opportunities.
And do you like this country?
Absolutely love it.
The CBI, the UK's main business lobby, has attacked the government's immigration policies, claiming they could deprive Britain of much-needed foreign talent and energy. Still, Prime Minister Cameron refuses to loosen controls. But as the humanitarian crisis in Europe intensifies, pressure's mounting on Britain to at least open its doors to more desperate refugees. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It's a relatively subdued day on Wall Street, all things considered. We'll have more when we do the numbers. On to a crisis of the business variety. Twitter, the company, is losing altitude. Its stock is down more than 20% this summer, and several top leaders have quit. A lot of that is because Twitter hasn't had a CEO for more than 2 months. The company's board met today to work on that leadership problem. But why is it so hard to find a CEO? And at what point do you need to just, you know, get one? Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
The number one job of a corporate board is leadership succession. So says Harry Kramer, himself a former CEO and chairman of healthcare giant Baxter International. Ideally, Kramer says, a company is constantly grooming several CEO candidates. And here's the key, internally.
Studies would say that 80% of CEOs who come from the outside, it ends up being a failure because they don't have the knowledge of the company, they don't have the knowledge of the culture. Very, very difficult.
For instance, HP's hiring of a software exec to run a hardware company. He lasted 11 months. As long as the odds are, sometimes you do want to take a risk on an outside leader with fresh eyes, argues former Kate Spade CEO Bill McComb. He was that guy, lured away from Johnson & Johnson to run a fashion company.
We were a company whose strategy didn't just get tired, it literally broke down. And upon reflection, they actually began to think that there were some advantages to not have an industry incumbent.
Either way, going without a CEO for months, which is the case at Twitter, can send a bad sign to investors and employees. Sidney Finkelstein of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth says companies can't look too long for the perfect person who checks all the boxes on the wish list.
And it becomes a walk-on-water candidate that pretty much doesn't exist. So check-the-box thinking is risky.
If there's one thing a candidate has to have, Finkelstein says it's the ability to adapt and adjust fast. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you're a business traveler who's been trying to catch up on Twitter while you're in the air, you have almost certainly asked yourself, why is in-flight Wi-Fi so bad? And on top of that, why is it also so expensive? Well, it's partly because there's only one company in the game, Gogo. Sam Grobart is a senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, and he did some digging for this month's issue. Welcome, Sam.
Good to be here, Molly.
All right, before we get into the reasons for, let's call it, the suckitude of Gogo
yes.
in flight, give me the origin story. How did Gogo end up in every plane that I fly on?
About 7 years ago, Gogo, which formerly had been a company called Aircell, which may ring a bell or two if you remember those incredibly expensive telephones that used to be in seat backs on many airplanes, the ones that would charge you $10 a minute. That was Aircell, and then Aircell, realizing that people really didn't want to spend that much money for a phone call, transferred its mission and some of its technology to start to provide the internet into airplanes. And they were the only player on the block. And as a result, airlines who were seeking new amenities and ways to kind of attract customers immediately gravitated toward Gogo.
I mean, the real question I think you try to address in this article, and that so many have wondered, is why is it so bad? What gives?
You know, it's an old technology, and it doesn't advance as quickly as our smartphone networks do, in part because the market is fairly small. There's less of an incentive for other companies to develop new products. As a result, Gogo has to build a lot of its own equipment by itself.
So you have outdated technology that doesn't work very well, but then you also have extremely high prices.
Right.
With surge pricing? Talk about this surge pricing. Insult to injury.
Yeah, so Gogo is, you know, abiding by some very sound economic theory. Unfortunately, sound economic theory has absolutely nothing to do with customer satisfaction. The problem is this. You have a limited amount of bandwidth. Right now, the best Gogo equipment can deliver 10 megabits per second to an airplane. But that signal is then divided among everyone on the airplane using Gogo at that time. In order to kind of keep everyone from flooding the network and then making it unusable for everyone, Gogo increases the price on flights that it has determined will have heavy usage. So a flight from New York to San Francisco, for example, which is likely to have a lot of very tech-savvy business users, is going to have a higher price than a leisure flight from Detroit to Miami, which are people, first of all, probably paying on their own dime and not with a corporate card or an expense account, and aren't that interested in remaining connected because they're just going to Disney World.
And is Gogo aware that people don't like it? People don't like their service?
You know, they are. And you know, they're not, they are neither evil nor stupid. And they recognize the problems that are going on right now with their service. And they're working very hard, they say, to bring better technology and faster speeds to planes to alleviate this problem. Their goal is to get more people to use Gogo. In order for that to happen, the service has to improve and the price has to come down. That being said, it doesn't make anybody any happier to know that, you know, they feel really bad about it.
So you're saying it's bad, it's expensive, and it's not going to get any better.
Basically, it's going to take a long time unless, you know, as we know from the world of technology, it's quite possible that in the next few years, some entirely new technology comes along and it's drone-based and it's, you know, using microwaves or what have you, that totally upends this entire system. But until then, it's going to be a sort of slow, plodding path toward slightly better service.
We will sit here and hope for disruption. Sam Grobart is a senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks a lot, Sam.
Thanks, Molly.
Coming up,
it's a different thing when you're the underdog and giving the finger to Goliath. When you're Goliath and you start giving the finger, you wonder, to whom is he giving the finger now?
Steve Jobs, the man in the machine. But first, let's do the numbers. Those numbers are mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 23 points, a 10th percent, to close at 16,374. The NASDAQ lost 16 points, 0.3 percent, to finish at 4,733. And the S&P 500 added 2 points, a 10th percent, to end at 1,951. Make it 5 consecutive days in the loss column for Netflix. The company returned 4%. Other tech companies in the red today include Amazon, off 1%, and Apple, down 1.75%. Verizon made another move to capture more of your eyeballs, agreeing to buy Millennial Media, which is an ad tech company, for about $250 million. It is all in the name of delivering more targeted ads to your smartphone. Verizon was up 0.8%, Millennial shares up 29%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.16%, and you're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I am Molly Wood. If you are Disney, it's not enough to make a movie anymore. Not by a long shot. But Disney's now legendary merchandise machine is in overdrive this week. At midnight today, Disney stores, Toys R Us, and Walmart will all open up to sell new merchandise and toys built around the latest Star Wars movie, The Force Awakens. To be clear, that movie does not open for another 3 months. But Disney, which now owns the Star Wars franchise, wants this rollout to be an event all its own. It's calling it, stay with me, Force Friday. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at this new milestone in merch marketing.
At the Toys R Us in Times Square, there's a big black box in the middle of the store covering up the products that will go on sale at midnight. And it's also hosting a handful of Star Wars-themed events. 16-year-old Jasmine Gill learned how to draw some of the characters.
I made BB-8 and R2-D2.
She and her very supportive mom are considering coming back for the midnight launch. She wants to see if there's a rancor.
You know, when Luke Skywalker, he gets captured by Jabba the Hutt, he gets thrown into this pit and there's a giant monster. That's that. It's a monster.
Yeah, she wants one of those.
What you have is a very popular, long-running franchise, which has fans of just about all age groups, combined with a very, very savvy and professional marketer in Disney.
Martin Brockstein is with the International Licensing Industry Merchandisers Association and says toys typically roll out about a month before the movie. This longer lead will help Disney sell toys, but promote the film too.
You know, a 10-foot section of toys in Toys R Us is also a billboard for the movie.
There's also a global push to this launch that shows how important the international market is becoming for the franchise. Sean McGowan is with Oppenheimer & Company.
If you look at a property like Transformers, more than half of the business in the last movie was done outside of North America. I don't know that you would make that forecast for Star Wars yet, but ultimately there's no reason why that wouldn't be the case.
McGowan thinks the movie and all the products that go with it will be really big. But he also cautions that expectations from Wall Street, Disney, retailers, manufacturers, they're all really high. The question is, are they too high? I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We've got an infographic where you can see the galaxy of brands involved in promoting the new movie at marketplace.org. Earlier in the show, we talked about finding the right CEO, and when those would-be CEOs think about who they want to be just like when they grow up, a lot of them would probably say Steve Jobs. The Apple co-founder and CEO is often held up as the model of a great leader who built a great company. Well, a new movie, Steve Jobs, Man in the Machine, opens tomorrow in theaters and on demand. In it, director Alex Gibney argues that, in fact, Steve Jobs got away with a lot because of his success. Things like massive tax avoidance at Apple, worker abuses in China, and a ruthless win-at-all-costs attitude that maybe we shouldn't be celebrating. Kai Rizdahl sat down with Alex Gibney to talk about the film, and here's that conversation.
There is no shortage of material on Steve Jobs, books, movies. What were you after in this film?
It was just a peculiar kind of question I had, which was when Steve Jobs died, all around the world, people were weeping. And that's rare for a big CEO, particularly the CEO of the highest valued corporation in the world. So I was curious as to why. And that led me down a path, which was the story.
The story is obviously of a man, complicated, interesting, curious kind of guy. Also the story, though, of this company that has become, I mean, you can't turn around.
Right.
It's crazy.
It is crazy. Way back when, they did an ad, the famous 1984 mm-hmm. ad that was aired during the Super Bowl, and they were kind of David to IBM's Goliath. Well, today, Apple has become Goliath.
You know, it's interesting because there is that very famous, besides the ad, there's that picture of Jobs standing in front of the IBM sign giving
his
finger.
That's right.
And I wonder how well you think he made the transition from iconoclast to icon.
I think he made it very well, except when it came to his values? Because at the end of the day, I think he was still giving the finger, though it's a different thing when you're the underdog and giving the finger to Goliath. When you're Goliath and you start giving the finger, you wonder, to whom is he giving the finger now?
He got away with so much.
Yes.
Because he created this stuff that to us is warm in our hands and occupies our minds. Did we let him get away with it?
We did. Not only we as consumers, you know, when it comes to the Think Different campaign, which represented a value system that, judging from the commercials, would have had us endorsing Rosa Parks, Mahatma Gandhi,
Einstein,
Martin Luther King. But also the SEC, for example, I think looked the other way with some very sketchy dealings over at Apple, particularly in terms of the stock option backdating that was done, and then also the non-poaching agreements that he engaged in with other globe-girdling companies like Google.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is stuff that, you know, we put people in jail for 20 years for stealing TV sets. And yet, because he was famous and the great Steve Jobs, there was a level of malfeasance that was tolerated because he was who he was.
The thing that I was waiting for in this movie that has come out in much of the other material about Steve Jobs and Walter Isaacson's book, it's there for a little bit, and in some other books, is was Steve Jobs the word I can't say on public radio. And while you get to some of his prevarications and his idiosyncrasies and you know, treating other people not great, I wonder why you didn't just come out and say, listen, this guy was a thing we can't say on public radio.
Well, one person, one of his early friends, does say it. He says, what kind of word you can't say on the radio do you have to be to be successful? And I think that is the big question that a lot of people are asking, because there are a lot of people in Silicon Valley who took it as writ that you had to be that word that we can't say on public radio in order to be successful. I don't think it's true. I think people made excuses for him because he was successful, for being the kind of guy who he could occasionally be. I should say he could also be very charming. You know, he was very conscious about human psychology, and if he thought charm would get him what he wanted, then he would use charm. If he thought it wouldn't, then he'd insult and vilify you.
At the end of the film, you circle back to your question about, you know, what was it that made people weep, basically, and you question, these are your words, the full nature of the transaction that we made with the maker of this machine.
I think it's interesting because he is all tied up with us. I think one of the reasons we wept was that he was our guide in this journey to become more intimate with our machines, particularly our computers. And so he was the personification of that long relationship that we had, in a way, with our own growing reliance and advocacy for these machines being part of our lives. So I think that it's that negotiation between the machine that he was very much responsible for, and I think that's one of the reasons why we wept.
Do you now look at your – you've got an iPhone 6 in your pocket, right?
I do.
Do you look at it differently now after making
this
film?
I do. I look at it a bit more as a machine. I tend to see more of its flaws. At the same time, I admit – I like its pretty surface. I like its zen-like black display. Yeah. And there are certain aspects of it that that I find hard to give up. That's the problem with the consumer junkie in all of us.
It's a film called The Man and the Machine about Steve Jobs by Alex Gibney. Alex, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note before we go, as you may have heard today, a U.S. district judge this morning overturned the NFL's 4-game suspension of Patriots quarterback Tom Brady over accusations of ball tampering last season. But what's interesting is that Judge Richard Berman basically made it a labor issue. He said the suspension had been improperly handed down under the league's collective bargaining agreement. So here's an incomplete list of the companies that Tom Brady has to thank for some of the labor laws that made that ruling possible. Lehman Brothers, Barclays Capital, John Hancock Mutual Life Insurance, Citigroup, McGraw-Hill, and the list goes on. All those firms were involved in previous labor decisions that were cited in the judge's finding. As to whether Tom Brady actually did it, yeah, I'm staying out of that one. That's it. That's our show. We are out of here. Today, the Dow gained 23 points, a 10th percent. The NASDAQ lost 16 points, 3/10%. And the S&P 500 added 2 points, a 10th of a percent. John Buckley, Deidre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I am Molly Wood. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.